From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a special edition of Stateside, the story of Richard Phillips, falsely accused, wrongly convicted in a 1971 murder. He refused a plea bargain.
That I would rather die in prison than to admit to a murder that I did not commit.
Decades passed before the Michigan Innocence Clinic discovered a key witness had lied.
The story he told the police was dramatically different than the story he told at a preliminary hearing, and then the story he told at the preliminary hearing was dramatically different than the story he told at the trial. This is a guy who couldn't keep his story straight.
Today, Richard Phillips is free.
I believed in God, and I believe that at no time would God actually abandon me and just allow me to spend the rest of my life in prison for something that I didn't do.
That's today on Stateside. Welcome to a special edition of Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today we bring you a story of murder, of injustice that took decades to correct, and of forgiveness. So imagine yourself going about your life, and then you're accused of murder, and nobody believes you when you say, "I didn't do it." You're convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life without parole. For decades, you make your case, you mount appeals, you try to convince those in authority that you are innocent, but nobody listens, and the years drag on.
16 or 17,000 days and nights, miserable, lonely, stressful nights that I had to spend thinking about the fact that my life had been taken away from me for no just reason at all.
But finally, the Michigan Innocence Clinic at the U of M Law School hears about you. They start digging, and they discover a key witness not only lied, that witness committed the murder. And at last, after a total of 47 years in prison, you are freed. That is what happened to Richard Phillips. The Detroit native was in his 20s when wrongly convicted of the 1971 murder of an auto worker named Gregory Harris. Today, Phillips is 72. He is the longest-serving exoneree in U.S. history, and yet he carries no bitterness for those lost years.
If I ever want anybody to forgive me for the things that I've done in the past, then I also have to do the same thing.
Richard Phillips will be here to tell us his story later in the program. But first, we turn to David Moran, the co-founder of the Michigan Innocence Clinic at the U of M Law School. David, how did you all become aware of Richard's case?
We became aware of it because someone tipped us off. And this person told us that a man named Richard Palumbo, who had been convicted along with Richard Phillips back in 1972, had gone to the Michigan Parole Board in 2010 and revealed that he and the prosecution's star witness, a guy named Fred Mitchell, were the ones who were really responsible for the death of Gregory Harris, and that Richard Phillips had absolutely nothing to do with it. And so we got the transcript of the 2010 Parole Board hearing and found out that's what Richard Palumbo had done. And then we went to see Mr. Palumbo. Students and I met with him, and he confirmed the story that he was, in fact, involved in the murder of Gregory Harris, but that it was carried out and orchestrated by Fred Mitchell, who ended up being the prosecution's star witness against Richard Phillips. And he confirmed again that they didn't even know Richard Phillips yet. The murder happened on June 26, 1971, and they didn't even meet Richard Phillips until about a week later at a July 4th barbecue.
That parole hearing was in 2010. When did you get that tip?
2014.
So we're talking 4 years since that came out.
Right. And so then we went to see Mr. Phillips, and he knew that he had been framed by Fred Mitchell, and he assumed that Richard Palumbo had also been framed by Fred Mitchell. And so he didn't know until we told him. In fact, we talked to him before we revealed to him what the information we had learned. He talked about Richard Palumbo, assuming he was innocent too. And then we revealed this information to Richard Phillips, and he was taken aback, to put it mildly.
I was going to say that moment must have been jaw-dropping.
So more than 40 years later, you know, he learns the true story of what actually happened on June 26, 1971.
And then what then? Walk us through the process of what it took from that point to get him to be able to walk outside as a free man.
Well, the students and I did a lot of research. Among the other things we wanted to do was we knew that there might be a claim that perhaps Richard Palumbo and Richard Phillips had colluded in this story. And so we wanted to make sure that wasn't true. And so we got prison records from the Department of Corrections showing that these guys had not been in the same prison since the early 1980s, which is, again, was consistent with the fact that Richard Phillips didn't know. Under Michigan law, you can use a polygraph examination in support of a motion for relief from judgment. So we had Mr. Phillips polygraphed, and he passed the polygraph with flying colors. And we got the original trial records and original police reports, as much of them as we could get our hands on, and fly-specked them and looking for all of the inconsistencies pointing to Fred Mitchell as the real killer. And what we saw was that Fred Mitchell's testimony was a pack of lies. I mean, it was internally inconsistent. The story he told the police was dramatically different than the story he told at a preliminary hearing, and then the story he told at the preliminary hearing was dramatically different than the story he told at a trial. This is a guy who couldn't keep his story straight. And the more we learned, the more obvious it was that Palumbo was telling the truth, that Fred Mitchell was your killer. He had just gotten out of prison for an earlier homicide. He had a motive to kill Gregory Harris because he told other people while he was in prison that he was going to kill Gregory Harris because Gregory Harris, he believed, had stolen money from Fred Mitchell's mom. And then a few weeks after Gregory Harris disappeared in June 1971, Fred Mitchell was arrested. He was a felon, a convicted killer in possession of gun. And that gun was of the same type that was used to kill Gregory Harris. And then a year later, in early 1972, just about the same time that Gregory Harris's body was found in Oakland County near Troy, Fred Mitchell was arrested again, this time for an armed robbery. And he says so he's in big trouble. He's going back to prison for a long time. And he says to the authorities, give me some help on this armed robbery charge, and I will help you solve this murder case where you just found the body. And so he had an explanation for everything. The explanation didn't make any sense, but he had an explanation like why he had the gun that was used to kill Gregory Harris. And he had a story that just didn't work.
It's just as you spell these things out, David Moran, it seems as plain as the nose on my face. Of course, Richard did not commit this murder and Fred did. How did the lies about the lies not trigger suspicions?
Well, that's a great question. I've had a number of students, about half a dozen students, who read the trial transcript in this case, and they all came to me and said almost exactly the same thing: is how did the jury convict? This guy was so obviously lying and he couldn't keep his story straight. And I actually had an assistant prosecutor tell me this at one point too. He said, I've read the transcript and I don't understand how the jury convicted. And so eventually we took this case to court and we were in front of Judge Kevin Cox, and Richard Phillips testified. And we presented the transcript of the testimony of Richard Palumbo from 2010, and Judge Cox granted the new trial. And then just about the same time, the Conviction Integrity Unit got started at the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. And by this point, the prosecution had filed an appeal to the Michigan Court of Appeals from Judge Cox's decision granting the new trial.
So the prosecution is still trying to keep him in jail.
The prosecution is still trying to keep him in jail. And in December, we got him out. We got a trial lawyer now on the team, Gabby Silver, who's a very prominent and well-regarded trial attorney in Detroit. And we added her to the team when we won the new trial, and she worked on the bond motion, and we got Richard out of jail in December of 2017. And then in January 2018, the new Conviction Integrity Unit came online.
And that unit's mission is to do what?
Their mission is to look at old convictions and see whether they should concede relief, meaning agree that somebody like Richard Phillips should get out of prison and stay out of prison. And so they filed a motion to stay the appeal. In other words, put the appeal on hold while we look into it. And the Conviction Integrity Unit looked into it. They interviewed They interviewed Richard Palumbo. They looked back the old records, and they even spotted something we missed, which was in his testimony, Fred Mitchell claimed that Richard Phillips and Richard Palumbo had this meeting a few weeks before the murder where they planned it out, and that Fred Mitchell, was somehow privy to this meeting where the murder of Greg Harris was planned out. But they noticed something we missed, which was that Richard Palumbo actually was paroled from a prior conviction he had the day before the murder. So that meeting couldn't possibly have taken place, and that story had to be a lie. And so that, combined with all the other lies that we had already proven, I think convinced them that Fred Mitchell was a liar and that he was the murderer.
What happened to Fred Mitchell? Where is he now?
He died years ago.
Okay.
He died many years ago.
What should this story you're telling us of Richard Phillips' wrongful conviction, what should it tell us about our criminal justice system?
Well, it's what we started to learn in the late 1980s, early 1990s, which is the criminal justice system is not as reliable as we thought. We have a good criminal justice system, but it's not perfect, and mistakes get made. And we need to have procedures and safeguards in place to make it more reliable. And so this case is a good example. If you go back and look at the more than 2,000 exonerations that are now cataloged on the National Registry of Exonerations, if you just Google National Registry of Exonerations, you can read about literally more than 2,000 exonerations, including Richard Phillips. And they basically all break down into a set of causes, such as bad eyewitness identifications, false confessions, bad science. And this case is one of them, and that is incentivized testimony. Somebody who has a very clear incentive. He's facing probably life in prison for an armed robbery conviction very shortly after getting out of prison for a killing. He's got every incentive to make a deal to throw other people under the bus. And so we need safeguards to make sure the jury is aware that they should be extremely skeptical about believing somebody like Fred Mitchell. And since the DNA exoneration started in the 1990s, and we've had more and more of these cases, and more than a quarter of these cases, I believe, have involved incentivized testimony, we've had so far just one state that I'm aware of, which is Illinois, which has passed rules that allows judges to exclude incentivized testimony unless there are reasons to believe it.
So that's a big step. You know, you have helped a lot of people at the Michigan Innocence Clinic. Where does Richard's case fit into this clinic's legacy?
He's number 18. So we have now exonerated 15 men and 3 women who between them served about 260 years, I think, of wrongful incarceration. So the average time between conviction and exoneration for these people is more than 10 years. Richard's case obviously drove the average up. Richard's case, he did more than 45 years in prison, which is the longest that anyone has served and been exonerated according to the National Registry of Exonerations. But his case is special because it shows that there's really no point back in time beyond which we can say, well, we don't need to go there, no matter how far they are. And in fact, there was an exoneration in Nebraska recently, a few years back, of a guy who was convicted in 1957. Now, he had been paroled decades ago, so he didn't serve as much time in prison as Richard. But even cases that far back need to be examined if there's somebody still alive that we can help.
David Moran, co-founder of the Michigan Innocence Clinic, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Richard Phillips, after the break. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, continuing now with the story of Richard Phillips, newly exonerated, thanks to the efforts of the Michigan Innocence Clinic. Its founder, David Moran, says this case should teach police, prosecutors, and attorneys to leave no stone unturned.
Richard's case, he did more than 45 years in prison, which is the longest that anyone has served and been exonerated, according to the National Registry of Exonerations. But his case is special because it shows that there's really no point back in time beyond which we can say, well, we don't need to go there, no matter how far they are.
So we turn now to Richard Phillips. Richard, after 47 years in prison, you've been out on bond since December, and at the end of March, you were officially exonerated and became a free man. How have you been getting along since getting out of prison?
Well, I've been trying to get my financial situation squared away, because as you get out of prison, usually if you've done a crime, what will happen is that they have these reentry programs set up for guys to come out that don't have anything like money and family and so forth. And so these reentry programs kind of halfway give them a chance to get started in life and get your life back in order and have you be in a position to where as though you can kind of halfway live normal without any kind of scuffling and struggling and so forth. But with exonerees, they don't really have programs set up for exonerees yet. Probably in the future, maybe they will have some people set up to help exonerees, because exonerees' situations is somewhat different. You get to the point where they say, well, okay, you're not guilty. Now we're going to let you go, okay? But you're on your own. So how do you make it on no assistance from the state, no health insurance, no food stamps, nothing? So I had to go through the process of not only getting some financial help, but I also had to get my Social Security card, identification, ID card. I didn't have any of that stuff. All that stuff was lost. Driver's license, everything was lost while I was gone for 47 years of my life. So I had to redo everything. Sometimes I had to go back and forth, back and forth. If you don't have this, you can't get this. If you don't have that, you can't get that. So it was a process, but now I've gotten to the point now where I'm kind of getting indoctrinated to everything that's going on. So I'm doing pretty good now. I'm staying with a friend. And so once the little money that I've actually applied for it starts to come in, they've increased my food stamps somewhat. So I'm doing a lot better than I was when I first got out.
So thinking about when you got out, Michigan Department of Corrections did what for you when you were released?
Not a whole lot.
How about the state or any Wayne County agency?
Not a whole lot.
You were flying on your own.
That's right. I was just glad to be free.
I'm sure.
So when I got out, people were talking about compensation and what you got coming and all of this, but that was never entered into my thoughts. My thought was just to be free. After 47 years of incarceration, staying in cold, dark cells, locked up, lonely, lost my family, lost everything. My kids lost everything. So now, after they released me, the process, I had to start like from scratch. It was almost like being born again. I had to learn how to use phones. I had to learn how to shop. I still don't know how to pump gas yet. There's a lot of things that have changed. So I have to still, I'm still learning.
And in that day-to-day, just looking around and realizing how much things have changed in nearly five decades, what have been some of the most challenging adjustments for you? You were saying even cell phone.
Well, let's see. I had to get used to buckling up the seatbelt.
Because that wasn't the law then.
Yeah. I could just get in the car and take off. Nowadays, if you get in the car, you better buckle your seatbelt up. If you don't want to get a ticket, buckle your seatbelt up. Not only for that, but for your health and for the safety of other people as well. So that was an adjustment. Shopping was an adjustment. I had to get used to the crowds. You know, being in prison, you're surrounded by untrustworthy people all the time. There's a lot of people in there that are halfway coherent, but there's a lot of people also in there that's not coherent.
And your guard is up.
And your guard is constantly up, all the time. If you walk out of a door, look both ways. If you walk into a shower, you better look around. If you go sit on the stool and try to use the bathroom, be careful, because it could be somebody standing up over you with a weapon. So you have to be careful. Prison is like that. Prison is not a place where you would want to anybody in your family to experience.
And are you you've been out now since?
I've been out since December the 14th.
And are you feeling less on guard? Is it happening for you?
Well, I'm getting help. You know, I think that anybody that has been locked up for as long as I have would have some type of trauma. And so what I've done this for myself. Nobody has said that I had to do this, but I've sought therapy. I've sought psychological counseling. And these things and these conversations that I have with my therapist that I have every week, I go every Thursday for therapy, helps me to adjust back to society, to get used to living again. The conversations that we have, we spend an hour, and she tries to give me guidance on the things that I should do, the things that I shouldn't do. I knew pretty much the things that I shouldn't do, but I need to know the things that I should do in order to get past the position that I am in now, which is like a stalemate. But I want to get to the point where as though I can, you know, be happy just mm-hmm. like anybody else. Find a home, get a home, maybe find me a girlfriend, you know, and just
live your life.
And live my life.
And to think that after 47 years, you get to choose what you will do, when you will do it, what you will eat. How does that feel to have the power of your life back in your hands?
That is an extraordinary feeling. Just to be able to turn the lights on, just to be able to take a shower. Do you know I hadn't, up until that time that I got out, I hadn't taken a bath. Mm-hmm. There are no baths in prison. I hadn't taken a bath in 47 years. So that was a comforting experience. I set me some candles out there, cut the lights on, put some bubble bath in there, and went for it. Turned it hot and just sit back and tried to let all the 47 years of pressure, tension, and everything else just melt away into the water.
Did it work?
It worked.
It worked.
I felt good.
When I look at you and I think that 47 years that you did, you're the nation's longest serving exonerated prisoner, and you've said you don't harbor bitterness or resentment or anger about what has happened to you so long wrongfully imprisoned. And that is remarkable, and it's hard to get my head around that when I thought about this. How have you gotten, Richard, to this place of forgiveness and working at letting go of the injustice that was done to you?
Well, I look at it this way. If you have animosity, if you're the type of person that carries animosity, then quite naturally, when something traumatic happens to you, you'll feel hurt and you dislike the process. You'll dislike a lot of the people involved in the process. You'll dislike the people that put you through what you had to go through. But I realized at some point, and I guess it had a lot to do with my spiritual acceptance, because I at some point I had to just say, well, look, this is a little bit too rough for me. I had to put it in God's hands. And so having gone through all that, I said to myself, then if I ever want anybody to forgive me for the things that I've done in the past, then I also have to do the same thing. And so I just decided that I would forgive everybody that has done everything wrong to me, including Fred Mitchell, because I kind of halfway understood where he was coming from when he did what he did, because you're not going to find very few people. You're not going to find very many people that's going to just say, I did something, send me away for life, as opposed to saying, he did it, send him away for life. Not too many people are just going to raise their hand and go away for the rest of their lives.
But you were the unlucky guy that he pointed to.
That's right. And self-preservation is the first law of nature. So that's what Fred Mitchell resorted to.
And that,
I don't like what he did,
right?
But I understand it.
That is something. If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Richard Phillips, who, after 47 years in jails and prison, has been released. He was exonerated. In fact, he is the nation's longest-serving exonerated prisoner. Over the years, did you try to get your story out there? You knew you didn't commit this murder.
I have tried numerous times, numerous appeals, you name it. Never gave up. As soon as one appeal would get turned down, I'd start constructing another one. Sometimes they would say, well, you've already filed this or you've already covered this issue. It didn't matter. I was going to keep putting paperwork into the courts and flood the court system for the rest of my life if I had to. But, hey, to no avail. It had to come from some other source in order for me to get my freedom. None of my appeals worked. Now I look back and I say to those people that were denying my appeals, the prosecutors that were fighting the case, I hope they can look back and also see that you're not always right. You can make mistakes too. And I understand that. And this is the reason why I'm not so bitter, because I know that everybody makes mistakes.
When the Michigan Innocence Clinic came to you and said, here's what we've learned, what did you feel?
I felt a sense of exhilaration, because there also was the sense that maybe there's a light. In other words, the door didn't open all the way, but there was a crack. I seen a little bit of light, and it made me feel, I don't know, like I had a chance. And as we went along, and more they investigated the case and brought me the information that they did, because there was a lot of information that I didn't have. I didn't know that Richard Palumbo was sitting in the back seat when Fred Mitchell shot that guy in the head. I didn't know that until they explained to me that he admitted it. Never once in all that time that I knew him.
You thought he was also framed.
I thought he was framed too. So I accepted it.
And then pieces come together. But it still takes a while for the system. How did you keep together day in, day out, thinking there is a light down there, but it's not? I'm not there yet.
Well, actually, my motivation really come from the fact that I believed in God, and I believe that at no time would God actually abandon me and just allow me to spend the rest of my life in prison for something that I didn't do. This was just my belief. This is the way I tried to accept it and embrace it. I put the spiritual aspect up to it, and I said that God is not going to let me stay here for the rest of my life for something that I didn't do. And he didn't. I mean, it took him a while to get it done, but I'm happy that he did.
And here you are. Was there a chaplain? Was there someone inside that was helpful to you that you could turn to? Or were you kind of going it alone all those years?
Well, I was pretty much going it alone. You know, I was trying to deal with what had happened to me. And then after so many years days go by. Somebody counted the days one time, and I think they said it was like 16 or 17,000. Days and nights, miserable, lonely, stressful nights that I had to spend thinking about the fact that my life had been taken away from me for no just reason at all. And the system at that point just seemed like a failure to me. And then, like when the light started and the door started opening up, I said, well, maybe the system does work. The checks and balances does work, but it needs to be refined to the point where everybody gets their due justice in court and they get to be, I don't know how you would say, exposed to the rights and wrongs of the justice system and allowed to get back into society, especially if you haven't done anything. In my case, I hadn't done anything. And the thing that is really interesting, as far as I'm concerned, which a lot of people don't know, is the fact that I not only got convicted of a murder that I didn't do, I got convicted of an armed robbery that I didn't do. Fred Mitchell also committed an armed robbery about, I guess, probably the same year, 71. And the people that were robbed picked me out of a lineup and said that I was the one that was involved, when it was actually Fred Mitchell, the one that was involved. And so I ended up getting 7 to 22 for an armed robbery out of Oakland County that I didn't do. Most people don't even know that. I was in prison when they came with the charge of murder. They didn't come to me. They went to Richard Palumbo and interviewed him. Mm-hmm. They didn't even interview me. It was almost like if I was a consolation prize. They were just taking me along for the ride. And so I ended up having, when they interviewed Mr. Palumbo in prison, because he took a cop to the armed robbery. He was involved in the armed robbery. Him and Fred Mitchell actually was the one that robbed the store. But I got picked out for it. Fred Mitchell got away scot-free. Both cases, the armed robbery and the murder. The armed robbery is still on my file in Oakland County right now. They're trying to
examine. Working on that.
They're trying to work on that, too. But I was just so caught up in the fact of the murder case that I wanted to get that off me, that I really wasn't concerned about the armed robbery.
And as that was kind of building steam, I understand you were offered a deal at one point by prosecutors that would have gotten you out sooner. And why didn't you take it?
Well, when Dave Moran came to me and spoke to me and said, well, look, I might be able to get you a deal here because that way we won't have to go to court. And, you know, the prosecutors seem as though they're acceptable in accepting a plea bargain just to get it off the court. They just don't want to make it appear as though they were the ones at fault. And at that time, I told him, and I still say today, that I would rather die in prison than to admit to a murder that I did not commit. And that still stands today.
I understand you are quite the gifted artist.
I don't know about all that. Well, I have some talent.
Tell me about making art. Why do you do it? What kind of art do you make?
I do all kind of art. My specialty or my main love is watercolor. I do them all, but watercolor is the one medium that I work in the most because actually it's coincidental that I work with watercolor. I ordered an acrylic set years ago. And they sent me the wrong set. So I said, well, I got it. I might as well use it. And from there, I actually taught myself how to use watercolor. It's the most difficult medium there is.
And had you ever done anything like this before you went away?
No.
So this is something you
just had the artistic talent.
Okay.
In school, as a youngster, the only class that I ever got all A's in was art and gym. Art and gym. Everything else was, I don't even want to talk about it. I don't even talk about the other subject. But art and gym, I got straight A's.
So you're making art now, and I bet that has to be part of just getting settled and healed.
That's where I get my comfort at. I can escape the world when I can get into one of my paintings and start applying colors and get actually off into some of the scenes, especially the landscaping scenes. I can once I get caught up in it and have music transferring in my ears all at the same time, I'll actually be right into the painting. My mind is focused inside that. And so this is one of the reasons why when I was in prison, it would give me an opportunity to escape because my mind was somewhere else inside this art, creating the art, the colors, applying them on the paper or whatever, instead of being outside where they're fighting, stabbing, acting crazy, doing whatever. Prison life is like that. Something is going on all the time, every day. And so one of the best ways to stay out of that is to actually apply yourself to some other medium or some other interest. And that way you can stay away from a lot of the nonsense that goes on in prison. Because out of all the years, which is remarkable, I had one of the guards to tell me at a commutation hearing that I had back in 2009. Mm-hmm. He said, if your prison record was enough to let you go on alone, I only had, say, like 4 misconduct reports out of 47 years, whereas some people get 4 misconduct reports in 1 week. You get these kids that come through there nowadays, they don't care about nothing. They don't care about nobody. They don't have anything on the street. They don't have no life on the street. See, prison now is like a badge of honor. Oh, I've been to the joint. That's the first thing you hear somebody say. But that prison is no place to be somebody. Believe me. You're going to be abused, used, taken advantage of. You'll get accused of things you don't do. And I've been there, so I've experienced it all.
You have said in interviews when you were exonerated, Richard Phillips, that you really, really hope to reconnect with your own 2 children who were,
right. What,
2 and 4 when all of this began for you way back in 1972. How has that gone for you?
Well, I've managed to contact my ex-wife. We've talked, and my son is staying with her. And we're in the process of mending all our relationships right now. My daughter, she stays in France, so I haven't had a chance to really contact or speak to her yet. But she comes over here to the United States 2 or 3 times a year. So eventually we're going to all get together and and meet up and try to get back together. And my wife and I are now just mutually friends, which is good. You know, I was hoping that it would turn out that way. Sometimes, you know, you get a divorce and people begin to hate one another and they don't want you to be around or talk to you, but that's not the case with us. At least we're adult enough to realize that, you know, when you're young, mistakes are made, you go through processes that don't last forever. So, you know, it was an experience.
I think I'm sensing some hope that you're carrying, that this will kind of come together and this family connection will get stronger.
It'll get stronger. It'll definitely get stronger. If it's on me, it'll get stronger. I know that.
What are some of your other goals now?
My next goal is to get an automobile so that I'll have transportation. Right now, I don't have transportation. And so I have to try to somehow manage to either save enough money, acquire enough money to be able to purchase an automobile because I need my transportation. I couldn't have got here today if Dave Moran hadn't have made it available for someone to come and pick me up. And so I need my transportation to be able to go to doctor's office, whatever, you know, and come here for this interview today. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been able to make it if I'd had to go depend on myself. They don't have a bus line running from one city to Ann Arbor, so I wouldn't have made it. So that's my next goal. And then a home, probably, you know, I'm looking to get me a pet. I've always said that I wanted a dog, so I'll probably end up getting me a German Shepherd puppy or something to grow up with. And after that, just live life, maybe travel, see how things go.
Because you're a young guy. You've got a lot of time left on this earth.
I don't know about being, I don't know about young, but I feel young.
How do you think your story could show our criminal justice system how to do better?
Well, for one thing, it would show them that all the convictions that they acquired over the years are not necessarily rightful convictions. It shows that mistakes are made and that there should be some type of safeguards put in place to protect people, especially like me, where you'll have someone just coming to court and just saying, oh, he told me he killed somebody. They never, in my particular case, no one ever said they saw me do anything. No one ever said that they saw me even in the same vicinity as the crime scene. No one said that they had fingerprints or anything dealing with that particular case associated with me. Fred Mitchell just said that I told him. And that could happen to anyone. That could happen to you. Mm-hmm. I could go to police right now and say, you told me something. And that doesn't mean that it's right for them to send you away for the rest of your life based upon just what I just said. Who said that you told me anything? There's no witness for that. But yet and still, you have to go spend the next 50 years in life based upon what somebody said that you said. Not that they seen anything, not that they have any evidence or any guns or bullets, fingerprints, just someone saying that you told me this and the jury believes it. You're gone for 50 years. That could happen to you, your mother, your brother, your father, your sister, someone in your family. Think about that. Just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, you could end up gone.
Richard Phillips, who spent 47 years behind bars for a crime he did not commit, the longest-serving exoneree in U.S. history. Richard, thank you so much for being with us, for sharing your story, and we are all wishing you the best as you build your new life.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history.
Yes, Michigan, the feeling's forever. Yes, Michigan, the feeling's forever. Beyond the forests you will see my cities rise majestically. I am Michigan. Yes, Michigan, the feeling's forever, forever.
All right, if you recognize that jingle and you started singing along, you're probably not alone. You're also probably not 20, because that Yes, Michigan tourism ad campaign is from the 1980s. Tourism certainly part of the lifeblood of our state. Think of this. Last year, out-of-staters spent more than $2 billion while touring our peninsulas. But when did Michigan tourism campaigns begin? Let's find out now as we welcome the state archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. So, Mark, we know the state's current ad campaign is pure Michigan. We've got, you know, Michigan's Tim Allen voicing them and the beautiful music by Rachel Portman. But what's the oldest ad campaign to try to lure people to Michigan?
Yeah, there was no song when the first one came around. We have to go all the way back to 1873, and a New Yorker named Charles Halleck wrote a book called The Fishing Tourist, and he dedicated an entire chapter titled The Michigan Peninsula and goes through blow by blow of all the lakes and streams he fished and how wonderful it was and how everybody should come here. That's also the exact time that the fish, the grayling, was first discovered in North America up near the town of Grayling, which is named after that fish. So it was this huge boon to state tourism. I mean, it wasn't an organized effort, but this gentleman just wrote a chapter and people started flocking here for the fishing. It was also featured in Scribner's Almanac. Michigan was featured in that almanac in the late 1800s for hunting and fishing. But this time period's really about specific resorts or shipping and railroad lines promoting themselves as a means to go north as opposed to the final destination or an idea of regional or statewide tourism. A great example is the Grand Rapids and Indiana Railroad's campaign in the 1870s, which they dubbed themselves the Fishing Line. And all their literature was either watermarked with the grayling fish, because that was the big discovery at the time, or a person with a fish hooked on their fishing line.
And then, so that's starting in the late 19th century. Take us through the 20th century. How did tourism campaigns evolve?
They started after we had better roads and proliferation of the automobile. Hugh Gray, in the late teens, comes out of West Michigan and starts an organization to promote tourism as we know it today. He was responsible for one of the first state slogans, Carefree Days, in Michigan. He also promoted something called the West Michigan Pike. It was a beach town tour along West Michigan. And it's the first time you see an association partnering with towns to boost their tourism. So it's really the forerunner of chambers of commerce. And then you also see these same organizations pop up in the UP, Northeast Michigan, Southeast Michigan, all following West Michigan's lead. You also see an interest in camping because people are getting out to these remote locations and they start camping, which pushes the Department of Conservation, which was organized in 1921 and is the predecessor to the DNR, think seriously about state park development, including camping facilities. And I think you also have to give a nod to the Civilian Conservation Corps, their work in the 30s that led to a lot of forest restoration and public works that are still enjoyed today.
Indeed. I remember putting in our canoe up near Kalkaska at the Triple C Bridge, which they built. So let's talk about the 50s, because the state then decided we need to get in on this and what, create Michigan Week? What's that about?
Yeah, in the 50s, the Economic Development Commission jumped on board. So it wasn't really tourism, it was more boosterism for retailers. So they created the Michigan Week campaign where they created all sorts of promotional materials for retailers, including grocery stores and grocers, promoting Michigan's produce that was created here. And the very first symbol of that was the robin. It was actually called Chesty Robin.
We use it
now at the Michigan History Center. We renamed it Proud Robin for obvious reasons, but it's what's on our admission sticker at the Michigan History Center. Mm-hmm. But all this material was just sent out, and they did different iterations every few years of the robin all the way into the late 1960s. And Michigan Week, if you're familiar with Yes, Michigan, you're familiar with Michigan Week as well. It's this promotion of everything that's great in Michigan in the third week of May. It's sort of gone through peaks and valleys as far as who's promoting it. I think it's still officially run by a group down in Sturgis, but it's really sort of lost the luster that it had in the past. But in the heyday of in the 50s and 60s, they did things like they pressed 45 records to be sent out to the radio stations to be played on air, and we have one in the collections at the archives, and we queued it up and converted it to digital, and we listened to Michigan the Beautiful, which I'll let you decide whether you think this is a really energetic promotion of the state of Michigan.
All right, go. Okay, that sounds like Michigan the Dirge, the Michigan the
Michigan
Funeral.
Requiem, yes.
Michigan Requiem, pretty funny.
Well, there's always a B-side, and so the B-side to this is a jaunty little number by the University of Michigan Symphony Band.
So when TV became mainstream after World War II, did the tourism campaigns have to up their game? What did we see?
Yeah, you saw Water Wonderland, and then it moved to Winter Water Wonderland. And one of my favorites that I don't think really caught on was one of the early 70s called The Michigans. And then the subtitle is The Almost Islands of the Great Lakes. That was a 71 campaign by the famed Detroit agency Ross Roy.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, this is conjecture on my point, but this is right at the dawn of the movement for the UP to essentially secede and become the superior state. So here you have the only evidence of a statewide campaign focusing on the two peninsulas, the Michigans.
You know, when I think of all of these campaigns, you've got to figure some politics got involved, which means we must turn to our own Rick Pluta to chime in with any war stories. So, Rick, what kind of politics might have gotten involved in these campaigns?
Well, when Jim Blanchard was governor, he took the Say Yes to Michigan campaign that had been started under Governor Bill Milliken and adjusted it. It became Yes! Exclamation point, Michigan.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was, Mark can fill me in, it was in the late 1980s, right?
Yes, correct.
And so we were leading into the 1990 gubernatorial race, and everybody knew that it was going to be Governor Blanchard seeking a third term versus the then Senate Majority Leader, John Engler. And there were complaints among Republicans and by the Engler camp and Engler himself that these promotions, both for tourism and for business, a lot of that money was being spent in state. And so it seemed like a promotion aimed at making people feel good about Michigan and the Blanchard administration and the way things were going and, you know, people, you know, showing optimistic thumbs up and stuff like that. And so there was a complaint that, you know, these promotional campaigns were also being used as political tools.
And how did that all play out?
Well, you know what? Governor Blanchard get to spend the money, but we know how the election of 1990 played out.
We certainly do. Quite a tour of Michigan's past tourism campaigns, as we've been talking with State Archivist Mark Harvey with the Michigan History Center and the political slant from our own Rick Pluta, our Michigan Radio Lansing Bureau Chief. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.